Election 2016, the New Mexico 2nd Congressional District Debate, with Republican Steve Pierce and Democrat Mary Lee Soles. Now from KRWG at New Mexico State University, Fred Martino.
Thanks for joining us. Over the next hour, we'll be talking about some of the most important issues for New Mexico and the nation. Candidates will have 90 seconds to respond to each question, and that will be followed by a 45-second rebuttal. The reporter asking the question may also ask for clarification from time to time. Our partner in the debate is the Las Cruces Sun News, and we are joined by Sun News Managing Editor Sylvia Ulloa and Editorial Page Editor Walt Rubel. And Walt has our first question.
And it will be for Representative Pierce. An annual report on childhood well-being showed that New Mexico has a higher percentage of children living in poverty than any other state in the nation. Beyond the federal assistance programs that help people survive, what can the federal government do to boost economic development efforts in the state to provide the good-paying jobs that people need to get off of those assistance programs?
Thanks, Walt. I appreciate each one of you being here. Sylvia, Fred, thanks to you. Congratulations to my opponent for being in the race. I'd like to also acknowledge my wife, Cynthia, in the studio audience today. The issue of poverty is one that should get more attention nationwide. I think I visited with you all when I was in the editorial review that it's a focus that is going to be tightened up considerably in the coming Congress. I hope to be a part of that. But the most important thing we can do is provide the young people with an education. I go constantly into our schools, visit with our kids, evaluate the kind of education they're getting. But secondly, we need to be aware of those jobs that are potential in a rural state like New Mexico. That's one of the reasons that we fight so hard for the rural jobs that are here. I think that we should start, again, cutting timber out of our forest. That was 123 mills at one point in New Mexico. A lot of those mills in the 2nd District, they've been shut down over government regulations. Mining, the rare earth minerals, used to be a very important job in southern New Mexico. A lot of times people are saying that we should get high-tech jobs. We have to be realistic. Those are going to go to the large population centers. We just need to do what we can with what we have. But beginning in education, making sure that our skill sets are as high as we can, that'd be important. Now, at one point, I brought employers from around the state into those very desperate conditions that you refer to. Yeah. We had not job fires, but hiring fairs. We hired 57 people on one day. I have taken representatives from those communities to some of the jobs here where they tell me they're looking
right.
for people.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Soul, same question. What can the federal government do to help provide good paying jobs here in New Mexico?
Thank you for that question. We need to be looking forward, not backwards. The backwards things that my opponent has mentioned are related to global competition. But we are stuck here in New Mexico. I would look to energy, clean and renewable energy, as a significant part of our future. I know from my business background, low-cost electricity is one of the key things that makes industry possible. And New Mexico has all of that potential. I would also look to connect the entire country. Connectivity today is a prerequisite to being able to do business. So broadband, internet service, that connectivity lets the people right here find opportunities, move forward. When we're not connected, we're not going forward, and we're being left behind.
Okay, thank you very much. Sylvia?
Hi, this question is for Ms. Soles. New Mexico voters have always placed a high value on the seniority in our congressional races, given the small size of our delegation in Washington. Steve Pierce is a well-established member now wrapping up his 6th term in office. Why should voters give up that clout and experience for a candidate who's never served in public office?
Absolutely. I am a political outsider. He's a longtime political operator, 12 long years in Washington. But he's given up on us. He's just going through the motions. He's not working for New Mexicans, for us, for our future. His main attention has been to take care of wealthy interests, special interests, people like him. I believe it's time for the people of New Mexico to have a real choice in who is doing the hard work of creating a future that works for all of us, not just a few.
Would you like to respond?
Sure. I think that that probably is one of the issues that distinguishes me the most, the ability to work through the years on very difficult problems. In 1968, there was a bill passed that gave southern New Mexico 18,000 acre-feet of water for the four counties in southwest New Mexico. Since 1968, that needed a signature by the Secretary of Interior. We worked on it, took us 12 years. The last day before it was going to lapse, we got that signature at noon on that day. Now we can move forward to harvest that water, more job opportunities through that water. But we also worked 12 years trying to get the Forest Service to back off and let the rancher, Mr. Goss, and his family have access to their water rights. We have fought tenaciously for the 2nd District, and so we'll continue that fight.
Mr. Pierce, our next question is for you. What is your position on abortion rights? Specifically, do you support the right to an abortion if a woman says that she has been the victim of incest or sexual assault? Further, do you support the right to abortion if there is a threat to the life of the mother?
Fred, I'm extremely pro-life. I will tell you that no country can stand by and not hear the voices of the most fragile in its population. The most fragile voices are those that are completely unborn. Now, we all know that life ends when the heartbeat ends, yet somehow we have a difficulty saying that life begins when the heartbeat begins. Recent research shows that's as early as the 16th to 19th day. So once that life is established, I believe then it is a constitutional mandate for the government to stand up for the fragile. At that point, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, those are the core values laid down by our founding fathers, and I believe that we have a responsibility to speak at that point. I am sympathetic and understanding of the situations that arise, rape and incest. Many times those are viewed as simply open doors. If we could find the right mix, the right regulations, then I'm open to the suggestion. But basically, right now, we're allowing in this state abortions up to the day of birth. I don't believe anyone would say that the fetus is not viable at that point.
Thank you. Ms. Soles?
I respect women as moral, responsible decision makers. My opponent apparently does not. And to suggest that this question can be better dealt with by government, which is not party to that very difficult decision, I think is hugely disrespectful. Women are entirely capable of making the most difficult decision in this area with the counsel of their medical professional and within the context of their faith. Government does not belong in this territory.
Okay, our next question will be for Ms. Soles. Both candidates running for president have indicated that if elected, they would expand military operations in Syria. Do you believe that the authorization for use of military force resolutions passed by Congress in 2001 and 2002 are sufficient to cover future military operations in Syria and elsewhere? And if not, what action should Congress take in regard to ongoing operations against the Islamic State?
I do not believe that the prior authorizations are sufficient. It would require reauthorization by Congress to set us on a path of putting our United States people in harm's way on the ground. I believe we have a responsibility to be part of the global leadership in containing the threat that ISIS represents to the entire world. But I would think that the last step we take is to put American lives in harm's way, at risk, on the ground. that definitely requires Congress to reauthorize an act of war.
Representative Pierce, do you believe that the authorizations in 2001 and 2002 are sufficient?
The president himself did not believe that he came to Congress for the authorization to use military force. I think he was correct in that request. Congress has not acted because he has never said exactly what he would do. What I don't want to do is authorize a blank check for this president, or frankly any other president, to go in militarily. I think we should look to our Arab allies in the region to lead that fight, to try to stabilize the area. This president has eliminated about 100,000 of his soldiers. The military is being decimated right now through the president's budget. We've got to rebuild the military, rebuild American strength, but mostly we have to have a vision for how we as America are going to lead through the future.
Thank you.
This question is for Mr. Pierce. America is clearly a divided nation politically, and it's been dramatically exposed not just by this year's election, but by years of gridlock under President Obama. If the current polls are correct, it appears likely that Hillary Clinton will be our next president. Regardless of who's elected, what would you do to try to improve the relationship between Congress and the executive branch?
I think the most important thing that we should do as a nation is to look at all of the gerrymandered districts. Of the 435 of us in Congress, only 35 of us are in competitive districts. This is one of those districts. Mm-hmm. So 400 are either very strongly Republican or very strongly Democrat. When that happens, then you can say and do anything. In this district, it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. You pretty well have to stay out where you can talk to both parties, and that's been evidenced in my service. Again, we worked with the Obama administration to get the Arizona water settlement. We worked with the Obama administration to get the settlement up there at Weed on the Goss Water Project. We worked with the Democrats in Congress to get the WIP funding. Our ability to work across the aisles comes strictly from my family background. Mom and Dad are registered Democrats most of my life, and so I respect that point of view. I just have a different one. As we deal with the president, as we deal with the executive branch, if we understand when we go in that we're going to approach the questions and the situations from a different point of view, and each side is justified in its point of view, that's what we've found to be successful. We'll continue that work, whoever is in the presidency. But frankly, we fought Mr. Bush as hard as we have fought Mr. Obama when I felt either was wrong. I've been willing to fight my party constantly if I think they're approaching it incorrectly for New Mexico and for the country. We'll continue to do that.
Right, and Ms. Wolf?
Last year, I went to work on behalf of my community when El Paso Electric asked for an unjustified rate increase. I know how important low-cost electricity is to bringing jobs to New Mexico. So I went as a citizen, filed to intervene, and took on what I saw as an unjustified rate increase. Instead of the $8.6 million that El Paso Electric asked for, they were granted only $1.1 million increase. That's $7.5 million per year, $75 million savings for my community, okay, because I went to work on behalf of this community and pulled together the appropriate stakeholders to make that happen. I think this is about results, delivered results, rather than just statements.
Ms. Solz, our next question is for you. Right now, income over $118,500 is not taxed for Social Security. If the cap were eliminated but benefits were maintained in the current form, the government says about 90% of the Social Security shortfall would be solved. Hillary Clinton has proposed taxing some additional income. Others have proposed further increasing the retirement age and cutting benefits, saying tax increases are not wise. How would you secure the future of Social Security?
Thank you for that question. Social Security is one of the most successful safety nets this country has ever enacted, providing retirement security to Americans for more than half a century. I don't believe that we should be cutting benefits. I don't believe that we should be raising the benefit eligibility date. I do believe we should immediately remove the cap. What happens today is somebody who is earning a good living, more than $118,500, once they reach that amount of earnings in a year, they essentially stop paying the Social Security payroll tax. That's like a windfall for the remaining months of that particular year. It's not part of what they're required to live on. It's not part of the budgeting. We could remove the cap immediately, make no change to benefits, and we would, as you said, we would solve the problem significantly in terms of any concerns about the financial health of our Social Security program. I would take that step as soon as possible.
Mr. Pierce.
Fred, I'm suspicious of anything that changes the core promise and agreement with our workers. What I've seen in the past is that both parties will take the money and spend it. Almost $3 trillion has been removed out of the lockbox. The lockbox has nothing in it but IOUs. Now our deficits are in the $500 billion range. Any money that we pay back to the Social Security Trust Fund is printed through quantitative easing. And so what I would do is find some new source of revenue, maybe offshore oil and gas resources that have not been produced up to this point, and allow all of those funds to go in to start replenishing that lockbox. The big problem with Social Security is that there are not enough workers. It was built on a different paradigm. You can't adjust that by small changes in the tax code.
Thank you.
Next question is for Representative Pierce. In June of this year, the Sun News ran a guest column written by the mayors of Las Cruces, Mesilla, Anthony, and Sunland Park, all in support of legislation by Senators Udall and Heinrich to create permanent wilderness designation within the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument. You opposed the granting a monument designation before the action taken by President Obama to create the monument, and now oppose the wilderness bill by Udall and Heinrich. Why do you believe that these local mayors are wrong on this issue and you're right?
Well, Walt, if you just take a look at the history of that, I began to stand for a common sense protection of the Oregon Mountains. I think we all agree that we don't want to see houses built up along the top of the crest of the Oregon Mountains. But we took an approach that would have protected 60,000 acres. Every time you get a more restrictive definition of public land, then you have less economic benefit. You can take a look at the Gila National, the Gila Wilderness, if you'd like to take a look at that. Look at the way that it's eroded the tax base for the local counties. Now, Las Cruces, Doña Ana County, about 15% of the land in your county here is private. That means every time that you want to build a new subdivision, you have to go and take land out of productive use, the farmland out of productive use, so you're cannibalizing your economy at the same time you're trying to grow your tax base here in the region. Now, when the Democrats had full control, if your hypothesis is correct, that all of the people support it, Democrats had the House, the Senate with a filibuster-proof majority, and the White House. You had Reid, Pelosi, and Mr. Obama, and they did not do that because the people in office knew they would be held accountable at the next election. So we fought Mr. Domenici, we fought everyone else all the way to this point to say that let's use the most restrictive designation, let's use the smallest footprint possible. Instead of 60,000 acres, 600,000 acres were put into protection by the president. I don't think the local populations were supporting that.
Okay. Well, the only thing I was putting forward was the position of the mayor and the mayors,
I understand the mayors, but when the people have the right to choose,
I understand.
The elected officials chose not to push that, and they had every majority in Washington.
I understand, Ms. Soles.
So I find it very interesting that my opponent represents this as the will of the people. I lived right here during the period when it was being proposed as a national monument, and there was overwhelming support. Support built throughout the communities here in Doña Ana County and the area that was affected. It makes no sense to me to suggest that we are land-starved. I experience anything but. This is not a land-starved community. And my opponent fails to acknowledge the value of protecting this legacy for future generations and the value in terms of tourism that is already picking up, bringing visitors from not just throughout the country, throughout the world. I believe the president did the right thing in the designation of the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument.
Right. Ms. Soles, at a previous debate sponsored by LULAC, you referred to the Veterans Affairs system as a model for health care. Yet a report last year by the VA's Inspector General found that more than 307,000 veterans may have died while awaiting care in the VA system. How can that be a model, and what should Congress do to ensure that those who are injured either physically or mentally while serving our country get the care that they've earned?
Well, let's be clear. The 307,000 possible deaths are just that. They don't know about those 307,000 potentials. They are files marked as pending, but it has more to do with the database than it has to do with confirmed deaths. There may be a few. There certainly is room for improvement, but compared to what other dynamics are going on in this country regarding health care, it's been established that the Veterans Health Administration has a better health outcome record at a lower cost than anything else that we're doing. We should be paying attention to that model as a potential model to address the affordable issue that we're currently facing in our universal health care initiative. I would reject outright that this is reason to trash it. I would reject that this is a reason to voucherize it, which for me is simply a matter of allowing private for-profit enterprise to get their hands into a big revenue stream from my tax dollars and your tax dollars. The Veterans Health Administration is absolutely worth saving, worth studying, and worth improving.
Mr. Pierce, would you like to rebut?
Yes, I have listened with respect as my opponent has said that I'm out of touch. I would recommend that she come to one of our veteran town halls if she really wants to find out how good the service is and if those are really imaginary deaths. I will tell you that our veterans deserve better. They deserve more. It was a bipartisan effort, both House, Senate, almost unanimous votes in both, with the president signing the CHOICE Act, which would allow you to take those vouchers off campus, off of the VA, allow you to access care when the VA can't get to you. We also allowed the VA to fire people who are not doing their jobs. One of the most revolutionary reforms in VA history, and the VA is still refusing to fire people not doing their jobs and to live within the constraints of the CHOICE Act.
So you think there's more work to be done there?
Say again?
There's more work to be done with the VAs. That's
absolutely
something you'll be pursuing?
The VA continues to mismanage, to allow people to languish. Just recently, in the last week, a report has come out about the colon cancer problem up at the VA in Albuquerque. No, the problem is just as deep as it was before the reform was passed.
Mr. Pierce, we'll move to our next question. Earlier this month, you spoke out against the non-binding Paris Climate Agreement. What should the federal government be doing, if anything, to address global warming?
The whole question of climate change originates at the point of, is it man-made or not? So understanding then what the question is, then you have to look at the political consequences downstream from any action that you take. Understand that this is basically going to, if the federal government begins to implement things, is going to result in a tax increase to the people in the second district and across the country. Now, the estimates, the low side estimate is that your taxes will double under a cap and trade program that was suggested 3 or 4 years ago by Mrs. Pelosi, a speaker. The high estimates are that your taxes will triple. So if you're paying $5,000 now and cap and trade is put into effect, then you're going to see $10,000, maybe $15,000 in taxes. At that point, I look at, if I've got to raise taxes for my constituents, what are the verifications? The IPCC was put in charge of, it's the International Panel on Climate Change. They're the ones who are keeping score. They're the ones tallying all the science worldwide. the emails that got released in a batch 4 or 5 years ago indicated that they're falsifying information, that they're manipulating the science. Then if you take a look at Al Gore's predictions, we didn't have to sandbag Manhattan yet. He gave us 10 years and said we're going to be in cataclysmic failure. That was 2006. We're not. Society still exists. So all of the examples used to say that we've got to pass this tax increase just haven't proved up. I think the federal government should stand still. We should do everything we can to clean up the environment. But I would hesitate to pass a cap and trade scheme.
Ms. Soles.
So my opponent continues to deny the fact of man-made global warming, as the rest of the world is stepping up to the real challenges that creates for all of us. He denies it to such an extent that he votes to prevent the United States Department of Defense from spending any money to prepare for the impacts of climate change, from addressing the issue of our national security with our naval bases being flooded. How irresponsible is that? We have a big challenge in front of us with climate change. We need to figure out how we're going to prepare for it, and what we're going to do to slow it, to stop it, and to reverse it, all of which we have the ability to take on.
And that segues into our next question, which is for Ms. Soles. Bloomberg has reported that there was a record $328 billion, invested in clean energy last year worldwide. China led the way with $110 billion in clean energy projects, more than double what was invested in the United States. What can Congress do to spur more clean energy production here?
We have a lot of barriers to clean energy right here in New Mexico. When I took on El Paso Electric, a significant part of that was related to their continuing to choose natural gas-fired generation at a cost of 10.9 cents per kilowatt hour, where just recently, Xcel Energy signed a purchase power agreement at 3.5 cents. Per kilowatt hour. We absolutely can be an energy leader here in New Mexico to be creating the energy technologies of the future, whether that's the renewable energies that we know today, whether it's energy storage, whether it's how to capture and contain those carbon emissions that are related to global warming. We have it right here. We have the national labs, we have the top-notch universities, we have the experience with energy production of all kinds. To not step up to that, to get the barriers out of the way, to get the special interests out of the way, and really take that on, we're doing our entire state and our country and the world a disservice. Now's the time to get on with it, open the doors, make the investments, figure out the technologies, and embrace it, because our entire world depends on it.
Representative Pierce, your thoughts on further clean energy investments?
The idea of having alternative energy is one that is important, but it also needs to be recognized for the limitations. It's somewhere between 3% and 4% of our national power. If we convert too quickly, which is what Europe did, you'll find that your cost of power go up. Manufacturers there, some are shutting down 8- and 12-hour shifts because of the high cost of energy. And so understand that if we pour ourselves headlong into this, as my opponent suggests, know that we're just going to lose jobs, and that's the long and the short of it. Storage is the key to any alternative energy. The wind doesn't blow every day. The sun doesn't shine every day, except in Hobbs and here in Las Cruces. But know that storage is the key. We've been to Sandia, asked them what they're doing to increase it. They say we're 40 years away from adequate storage. I put a bill in that would let us have solar on public lands in massive amounts, so we support it. But the idea that it can replace coal and oil and gas is one that's way premature.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Pierce, I'd like to ask you. In 2015, a federal judge overturned efforts by the Obama administration to provide protection for deportation for children who were brought here illegally and their parents. That ruling was allowed to stand on a 4-4 tie by the current 8-member U.S. Supreme Court. If Congress does take action on immigration reform in the upcoming session, What protections, if any, should be offered to these so-called dreamers and their parents?
When my family moved to the place where I grew up, it was 5 miles south of Hobbs. I used to go out, Mom would take all of us six kids out with the Braceros. The Rascones were the kind of the host for the Braceros. And we would work there in the fields at a very early age, hoeing cotton, later picking it. At that point, I really began to understand what it was and people that would bring them here trying to just provide for their families. And the dreamers are an offshoot of that. Families come here, try to feed them. I can understand the status of the family, but the kids that get caught in it are one of the ones that are one of the situations that drive your sympathies to the highest level. I've met with the dreamers here in Cruces. We talk. I tell them, look, I don't mind solving the problem, but what in policy you have to do is get to where you don't have to solve it every second or third year. In other words, you got to fix the problem, not just solve it currently. I've told them, please bring me back your ideas of how we could fix that permanently, and we'll take a look at it, and if it's valid, we'll push it forward. But deeply problematic, the idea of simply saying we're going to fix it now and then we're going to fix it again later runs the possibility that that's then the de facto way that you get into the country. So that's the piece we have to fix.
Well, what specific protections do you think that they would deserve? I mean, you have been involved in some immigration.
Yeah, the president went so far as to say we're going to delay any action on you. And the courts have said he did not have that responsibility or have that right to do that, not the constitutional right. He had said the same thing the year before. Again, I would take a look at anything you have to do has to be replicated in the future. That's the difficulty. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure at this point what we would do. It needs solution. But to simply say that if you're brought here and you stay here, then it's going to be okay eventually, that is pretty loose as an immigration policy. So if you have suggestions, I would welcome those too. But it's a very difficult one, and very few people in Washington come up with a solution except just go ahead and give them citizenship today, and that's what the president was hedging towards. Again, the courts are saying, wait, that's not going to work.
Okay. Would you like to address the Dreamers Act and how we might go forward on immigration reform in this country?
Thank you. I would. After a lifetime in New Mexico, claiming he's thinking about it, after 12 years in Congress, claiming he's thinking about it, and he still has no ideas, I would say we need to immediately grant legal status to those people who are here without documents living in the shadows. It changes nothing. It hurts nothing. We should then fix the process, a process that takes 20 years for someone who wants to come to this country legally is not a process. My manufacturing background says that's not a process that works. Let's make that happen. And finally, we're better than this. We can solve this problem. We need to stop making it a matter of political slogans and simply get on with making it possible for people to live here legally. That should be the easy part. It should be hard to live here illegally.
Ms. Soles, the next question is for you. The Affordable Care Act includes a Medicare surtax on wages and self-employment income above $200,000 for singles or $250,000 for couples. Many Republicans, including Donald Trump, say the Affordable Care Act should be repealed. Proponents say it's only fair that the wealthy should help pay for the Medicare expansion, which includes eliminating the prescription drug coverage gap or donut hole by 2020. How would you secure the future of Medicare?
I thought you were asking about the Affordable Care Act, and you asked about Medicare. I'm proud that this country has decided to commit to comprehensive health care for everyone. There are 20 million people today that have health care that didn't have it before. We've gone such a long ways in making that possible. We should not go backwards. I'm completely against the notion of repealing the Affordable Care Act. I do believe we have work to do on the affordability part. We haven't stepped up to the things that make healthcare in this country the most expensive health care in the world with only average results in terms of health outcomes. Again, we're better than that. So we need to take on the issue of the high cost of prescription medication. We need to take on the issue of a shortage, limited capacity of trained physicians and trained, skilled healthcare providers. There's a number of other things we should do in terms of really taking on the affordable part, the next important part that makes this work for the greatest country in the world. Healthcare as a universal right and privilege is something I totally support. Let's continue down the path and continue to make it better and continue to do what we're able to do.
Mr. Pierce, we know that you are strongly opposed to the Affordable Care Act and have voted numerous times to repeal it. This question is about how you would secure the future of Medicare. And as I mentioned, part of the Affordable Care Act expands the Medicare prescription drug benefit and many other things. How would you secure the future of Medicare?
Understanding how the Affordable Care Act was paid for up front and how the costs were delayed into the latter part of Mr. Obama's regime begins to reveal many of the weaknesses that are now being exposed. The co-ops are bankrupt, 16 of the 23 co-ops that we funded up front. We gave them the money. They spent the money and now they're bankrupt. The exchanges are in deep trouble. Skyrocketing premiums are going on. But the initial funding for this, $700 billion, was taken away from Medicare in order to make the books balance. They never did balance. They never will balance.
How would you secure the future of Medicare?
I would first of all repeal this act. We'd start paying attention and diverting the funds back into Medicare the way that they were before. We need to look at the loopholes in Medicare. We need deep reforms into that. But I would be paying attention to the Medicare, Medicaid pieces rather than having this one whole system called Obamacare. It is not working. It's not going to work. But return the resources back to where we took them.
Thank you.
Representative Pierce, last year you confirmed your membership in the House Freedom Caucus, which has been defined by pundits in many different ways. How would you define the House Freedom Caucus, and why do you believe that your membership benefits the voters of Southern
The House Freedom Caucus is probably embellished more than any single thing in Washington. All we are, in my opinion, is a backbone for the Republican leadership. We are there to hold them accountable to the things that we feel like are important to the future of the country. The real debate does not occur on the floor of the House. That's usually a pro forma debate with talking points on both sides and orchestrated outcomes. Everyone knows where it's going. So the Freedom Caucus is a spot where tremendous debate back and forth on the principles of a matter occur. And then before we take any action, then we go and visit with leadership and say, look, we're very nervous about what you're doing with TPP, for instance, lame duck session. The idea is that might just get slipped into a bill. And we're saying, don't slip it into a bill. If you're going to try to do it, then make it one of the issues of debate. Let America watch what's going on. And so that's basically what the Freedom Caucus is. Now, the benefit for us here, New Mexico is a fairly independent state. They began to recognize early on that Mr. Boehner, you could like or dislike the party. That was never the question. The question is he doing the right thing for the country? When he brought me into his office and said, Steve, you're not a very good team member, I was able to say, well, sir, I didn't come here on a team. I came as an American. I run proudly as a Republican. But this force to put the Congress back on the track we're supposed to be on is basically all we do.
Okay. And Ms. Soles, is an outsider looking in, what are your thoughts on the Freedom Caucus?
So I listen to my opponent, and he says nothing about serving the people of Southern New Mexico. It's one more example. He's given up on us. He's busy worried about the backroom politics. He's busy worried about who he said what to, what he told so-and-so. He's not looking out for the interests of those of us who live here in Southern New Mexico. So I still don't know any more about the actual principles the Freedom Caucus represents. I know no more about how that fits into serving the people in this district here in New Mexico.
Ms. Sulls, SunZia, a private energy company, has proposed running a clean energy transmission line through the northern extension of White Sands Missile Range. Congressman Pierce has expressed concern that that line would negatively impact the mission at the range and has called for the route to move. Do you agree?
This may be one of those few issues I do agree with Congressman Pierce. The SunZia transmission line is designed to take wind-generated electricity from the eastern side of New Mexico and transmit it to Arizona and California. Now, at this point, the New Mexico legislature has not figured out how to take a revenue stream out of that electricity generation. It's not covered in our severance tax mechanisms that provide state revenues. I believe they need to step up to that. The second piece of this is it provides no benefit to New Mexico. It's not clean and renewable energy to be used here in our state. In regards to the White Sands Missile Range, I think New Mexico, southern New Mexico, this district, has a national treasure in the White Sands Missile Range. And while I appreciate that it's the so-called extension area that the SunZia line would traverse, that is still very important to the capability that exists nowhere else in the world that we have right here to conduct testing. I would not want to compromise that capability in any way. Therefore, I continue to listen to the people who are directly associated with the role of the White Sands Missile Range and make sure that they would not feel that compromise.
Congressman Chair, is there anything you would add?
Well, you're aware that we've had many conversations on this in the past, and I still believe that we've been exactly right on it. The idea that we would put a high voltage, tall transmission line right through a restricted area is one I told SunZia, look, I'm comfortable with your mission. Just don't get in or close to the restricted area. I have access to the aviation charts. I've flown into Mexico my whole life. They went right across the northern border. Doesn't matter if it's an extension area or not. It's part of the restricted area. The estimates were it was going to decrease the emissions by 30% at White Sands. And I can tell you, at this stage of the game in Washington, if you see a 30% decrease in the mission, you're going to see all of those funds leave. There would be no reason to operate the White Sands for 70% of the mission. I still believe that's correct. I'm interested in our national security, but it also provides $1 billion worth of jobs for this area. We're going to continue that fight.
Mr. Pierce, you recently voted for a House bill to stop a Labor Department rule that would expand overtime eligibility beyond the current level of $455 a week to $913 a week. So currently, exempt employees making more than $23,660 a year can be excluded from overtime. In your view, when should workers gain overtime protections?
This is an issue that we had a lot of feedback from local counties, cities, and small businesses. I think that that the understanding of what should be overtime is simply between the employer and the employee, whether it is the county, state, or a small business. What's going to happen is that many of your small businesses here in Las Cruces are going to find themselves less competitive. They're going to find themselves harder pressed to hire people. They're going to go to more part-time employment. They're going to try to find ways around it. So if the objective of the rule was to make small rural areas weaker, then it's going to accomplish that. Again, I believe that the government has very little status in deciding the relationship between an employer and an employee. That's one of the things that gets us into big trouble as we make laws in Congress. Keep the government in its lane. Let people try to do the best they can to stay in business and provide jobs. I think that the communities are going to be better served. There are always downstream unintended consequences when someone sets up something like this. Companies just struggle to be competitive worldwide. We do not need to be doing things to make us less competitive against the pressures from China, India, and the other countries in the world.
Ms. Sulls.
Well, I reject the basic premise So this country, over many, many decades, has consistently stood up to protect workers from exploitation by employers, whether that's a 40-hour work week, prohibitions against child labor, overtime protections. This is part of what makes the United States great and is an appropriate role for government. I reject the idea that we have to have a race to the bottom by exploiting people who don't have a voice strong enough in their relationships with their employers. So I'm very much in favor of the government taking the appropriate steps to protect workers and their overtime opportunities. It's the right thing for us to do.
Okay, our next question is for Ms. Soles. As racial tensions have increased between police departments and minority communities in the wake of recent police shootings, the Federal Justice Department has taken a larger role in overseeing local police departments throughout the country, including in Albuquerque. Do you believe that this is an appropriate role? And what else, if anything, can the federal government do to improve the trust between police and the communities they serve?
I'm very much in favor of local policing, community policing. And yet, when the federal government is called in to assess whether or not local law enforcement is finding that right balance in terms of protecting us and working with us versus militarization and unnecessary force, I'm glad there's a fallback in the federal government. We need to continue to find the right balance. We need to continue to challenge our assumptions about force and its use and how we use that in a balanced manner only when appropriate, without targeting specific populations, specific minorities, or reacting in inappropriate ways. We all have a stake in the safety and security of our communities. I want to see the federal government and local enforcement working together.
Okay, Representative Pierce, your thoughts on what the federal government can do to help bridge that gap between police and communities?
First of all, I believe that any time a circumstance arises between the police and anyone else, that it should be investigated. And the DOJ is not a harmful body to do that, take an independent look. I think that wrongdoing should be punished. But at the end of the day, we must respect the police and get that respect from local communities. And that's where we're challenged in this country right now. If we don't have police presence, we're simply going to have chaos and a breakdown in the social order. We're seeing that in some of the communities that have been affected. I'd like to make one comment about the last question. My opponent says she rejected the basic premise that that government should protect its workers from exploitation. She was in management when her company shifted employees to a different country, and also they eventually filed bankruptcy. She has seen the problems of too restrictive labor organizations and agreements, and yet she still says.
Pierce, you're referring to General Motors?
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Okay, we'll give you a chance to respond to that.
Thank you for that. So I work for a division of General Motors, Packard Electric Division, and my time there as an executive was through the globalization process. We went from being a local company to being a company doing business throughout the world. Throughout that, I'm proud to say, we did that with the labor union. It protected the jobs of those union workers in Northeast Ohio. I often talk about my experience when I was part of a committee that was determining where we would place our next manufacturing facility. It was very much related to low-cost electricity and infrastructure and an educated, capable of workforce. What people should know is that given the choice between putting that facility in Mexico or in Mississippi or in Northeast Ohio, the decision was to put it in Northeast Ohio with a union workforce.
Okay, this question is for Mr. Pierce. You've frequently opposed votes by Congress to raise the debt ceiling. Treasury officials have warned that if you had been successful, it would have resulted in the nation defaulting on its debt. What do you believe the ramifications would be if Congress were to refuse to raise the debt ceiling?
You are correct. I have, not in every circumstance, but generally I'm opposed to raising of the debt ceiling. We do not have a problem in this country with not borrowing enough money. Many experts have said that the debt ceiling and the debt are the biggest risk to the country that we face. Now, at one point in President Bush's term, if we had just gone after and addressed the fraud, not the waste in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, but the fraud, people saying they're selling things that they're not. Those three departments have a combined $200 billion in fraud, and they know it. The CBO says it. And so if we had simply done that, we could have balanced the budget at that point. But neither party is willing to take on the very difficult task of going into programs and finding what is working and what is not. My business background says we're never going to succeed if we do not do that, and yet Washington seems immune to it. So I feel that always we could find the savings. Duplication is another source of extraordinary deficits, $200 billion a year in duplication. An example, we all would want childhood nutrition, but the estimates are there's something like 123 programs. If we would get rid of that, then we could begin to balance the budget. I think that's where families would want us to go.
But how do you address the idea that defaulting would create a big
idea that we were going to default economy is always one that is pitched up and has no validity at all. The government is required to pay its debts first, and so that was simply pitched out as a political slogan. There was not a chance that we were going to default because it is written into the rules of how we're supposed to prioritize our payments. If we would begin to segment the budget and figure out how we could balance a budget without hurting people, we do not have to raise the debt ceiling.
Ms. Soles, how would you handle the debt ceiling?
Well, I would raise it to match the commitments that Congress has already made. In 2013, I was employed at White Sands Missile Range when my opponent saw fit to vote against keeping the government running, raising the debt ceiling. The result of that was that in addition to the government not doing the work we expect it to do, hardworking Americans were on the street without a paycheck and no idea when they were going to be able to go back to work. These were people that had mortgages to pay, they had families to feed, they had responsibilities. My opponent sent out a memo encouraging them to go down to the local bank, to the payday loan lender, and take out a loan before they defaulted on their obligations. For me, shutting down the government crosses a line. When people in Congress found a compromise to move forward, he voted against it again. For me, he's not connected with the people here in Southern New Mexico.
We're out of time on that. Mr. Pierce, I'll let you respond. Absolutely. Because it was a specific allegation of a memo and a vote. Please do respond.
The memo did not come from me. It was a Facebook post that a staffer put up, pulled down immediately. That staffer is no longer with us. But the idea that we in the House, that I voted to shut down the government, is one that is simply political talk. We voted three times in the House. We sent three different funding mechanisms to the Senate, and it was Harry Reid that turned those down. The last one was so offensive that all we said is that, Mr. Reid, your staff wrote themselves an exclusion to the Affordable Care Act. At least all the staff in Washington should have to comply with what Americans have to.
Okay.
Mr. Reid blocked that, too. So the Senate Democrats are the ones who were really responsible.
We now move to closing statements, and we begin with you as the draw of the straws.
Well, thanks again to all of our viewers. Thanks to the Walt, Las Cruces Sun News, Sylvia, Fred, we appreciate you all. And thanks to my opponent. I appreciate your willingness to run. This is a noble job, but it is a hard job. And so your willingness to run is important. I'm here today trying to earn your vote. I would appreciate that as we come to Election Day. My belief is that we can do things in a bipartisan fashion, and I think I have led by example. If you take a look at the Arizona water settlement, that was the Obama administration and myself. If you take a look at the WIP funding, we kept that entire facility operating. That was Democrats and Republicans on the floor of the House finding our way to a solution to that. We're cleaning it up. That means jobs are going to continue. We settled the Goss water problem, a 25-year problem for the family. It should not take congressional intervention to get your constitutional private property rights, but after 12 years, we got an agreement just a couple of weeks ago on that. We led the bipartisan efforts to fix Native American housing. We passed the bill, a bipartisan effort to get significant cultural items back to Indian reservations. We have led the fight on HUD reforms. And so my request is that we look at the need to find people who will work across the aisle, who can find the middle ground between the two parties. This state, this district, puts me in a perfect position to do that. I think that I've honored the promises that we have made. I've honored the responsibilities that we have. And so I simply request your vote. Now, one last closing statement, and that is that people feel like that if one party candidate wins the election as president or the other wins, that we're sunk as a country. The strength of the country comes from you and I. Strong individuals make strong countries, not Washington. God bless you and thank you.
Ms. Soles won our draw to conclude.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a job interview. I'm seeking to serve as your next Congresswoman. My opponent, after 12 long years in Washington, is seeking another term. I'm a political outsider. He's a longtime political operator. I see a future of opportunity. He's still desperately holding on to the past. I'm asking you to fire him and hire me. Please ask yourself, do we need someone who is just going through the motions? Or do we need a representative who will do the hard work of taking on the challenges that face our state and our nation? Ask yourself, do we need someone who tells, talks, scolds? Or do we need a representative who has demonstrated that she can deliver $75 million of savings for her community? Ask yourself, do we need someone who has given up on us and who is only protecting the interests of the wealthy and the special interests? Or do we need someone who will fight against the special interests and fight for a future that works for all of us? My name is Mary Lee Soles. I will show up for you. I will stand up for you. I will fight for you. And together we will create a future that works for all of us. Ladies and gentlemen, I ask for your vote. I ask that you put me to work as your next Congresswoman. Thank you, KRWG, Las Cruces Sun News, for hosting this event. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Congressman Pierce. Thank you at home as well. That is New Mexico's second congressional district debate. I'm Fred Martino. On behalf of public media organizations across the state, thanks to our candidates, to the Las Cruces Sun News, and a big thank you to our supporters for making in-depth broadcast journalism possible. Have a great week.